I thought this morning I might literally be preaching to the choir. But look how many of you showed up. Yay. They say there's nothing new under the sun, right? Like sermon titles, for example. You come up with one that you think speaks to what you've been wondering about, like the space between head and heart. What is that space? How do we navigate it? In this complicated and shifting and ever-changing world where it feels like things are sometimes increasingly polarized, how are we balancing these two things for the better? Assuming there is space between head and heart, how does it impact the choices we make? How does it impact our living? And then you Google it just to see if anything comes up. And sure enough, a series of TED Talks with exactly the same title. So for those of you uninitiated, TED stands for Technology, Education, and Design. And there are TED Talks on just about any topic you can imagine. They're usually 10 to 20 minute segments. You can find them on YouTube. They're awesome, and I have yet to see one that I didn't think was informative and creative and inspired. They're really amazing. It turns out there was a conference in December of 2012 in San Jose called The Space Between Head and Heart, featuring a woman named Susan Fonseca, who was the founding architect of Singularity University, which is itself worth looking up because it's an amazing concept. She was also founder and CEO of Women at the Frontier, According to her bio, Susan works to create a dynamic forum highlighting female game changers from around the globe who are leveraging exponential technologies, designing innovative platforms, and creating positive social impact. She looks like, if you watch her TED Talk, an amazing rock star. And if you watch it, you'll learn that she watched her father die of liver disease before she was able to rally the resources that she knew already existed to provide a transplant for him. So for her, there is no distance, she says, between head and heart. They are linked in the passion she brings to her work, solving global issues with existing technologies. She's really quite amazing. But I'm not sure that the rest of the world is on board with her assumptions about head and heart. I think much of the world is still stuck in some very binary thinking about heads and hearts. Binary thinking, you know, the black and white, the either or. It lacks nuance, and it forces us to feel that we have to make a choice between two extremes, or at least between two ends of an issue. So our head, we know, is the rational, practical side, of course, of our thinking, unfettered or uncluttered by emotion and by the messiness of feeling and sentiment, passion, excitement. It's the part this morning that might have said, "Stay home. It's sensible." Our heart, on the other hand, the mushy part, the messy mix of internal responsiveness that threatens to sway our clear thinking in bothersome and unpredictable fashion. No, you like your community. You like church. Get out of the house. Many times we find it easier and simpler and cleaner to keep these two things very separate. Head over here, heart over here. Sometimes, of course, either or thinking might be prudent, even useful. Excuse me. We could imagine a time when either or thinking might have been a matter of survival. Either the animal survives or the human being does. Either or thinking is useful sometimes in arenas of right and wrong. That's not your car. Don't drive off in it. But many things, most things, I think, are not so clear-cut, even though culturally we may be encouraged to think of them that way. So we can imagine some either-or assumptions in the world around us. Either, for example, I can make a difference in the world and do good, or I can make money. Either I can be relaxed and happy, or I can be accomplished. Either I trust science to provide explanations to things I don't understand, or I look to religion to help me make sense of the world. Relative to that last either-or, William Sloane Coffin would remind us, who we heard from earlier, we forget that both the tree of life in here and the tree of knowledge are deeply rooted in the soil of mystery. What if we started appreciating both and, as he suggests? What if we started challenging cultural assumptions by imagining things like making money in order to make a difference? Or measuring our accomplishments by the degree to which they allow us and those around us to enjoy happiness? Remember the saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too. We use it when we want to communicate that you can't have everything, when you have to choose. Although it feels a little cockeyed sometimes, since you can't eat cake unless first you have it. So in fact, originally, it was written the other way around. It turns out that in 1546, John Heywood wrote, "Would you both eat your cake and have your cake?" Which feels like a subtler way of suggesting a problem. If you eat it, you won't have any more. So maybe you're looking for a way to do both, as opposed to having to choose either or. The byproduct, this is what's coming up, is because I was an economics major, the byproduct of consuming something is literally that you won't have it anymore. So in economics, that is referred to as an opportunity cost. What happens when you make an either-or choice? The interesting thing is that opportunity cost takes into the account that there are costs associated with a given opportunity that may or may not be directly proportional to the event. So the opportunity cost of eating your cake, for example, may be that not only do you no longer have it, but it's no longer available to share with your neighbor. So you have denied yourself a chance to create community that you may have been looking forward to. So now you have nothing to offer your neighbor either because you ate the cake. What if you had eaten some of the cake and saved the rest for later to share, both and? Maybe that depends on the size of the cake. It's easy to imagine that our impulses are affected by scale, right? What are our resources, and how much does it actually cost us to make any given decision? The head and the heart, the nuance, the gray zone. Will we take care of ourselves and our own, or will we provide to the best of our abilities for all? How big is the space between our practical head that measures and quantifies and our hopefully loving and boundless heart? Lawyers, I've been told, are warned against asking a witness any question to which the attorney does not already know the answer. Is that familiar to anybody? It reduces the element of surprise that can undermine a good litigation plan. So the same warning might be appropriate for anyone offering a story for all ages with children present. You may remember that several weeks ago, I was introducing Martin Luther King's concept of the World House with our children. I was inviting them to populate the house here on the chancel area and asking how we might manage having so many people in one small house. And I was anticipating comments like, well, we would share, or we would talk to each other, or we'd be generous. And what I heard was, we might want to kick some of them out. So So my immediate reaction and words were something like, oh, well, I don't think that's a very good idea. And then we moved on. But if I had been more on my game, I would have recognized and maybe even mentioned that, in fact, that's a response that many people likely feel. But we adults are often filtered enough not to share it. So we are saved by the honesty of children, perhaps. When space is tight, when our resources are challenged, when our cake is small, or the neighbors or our house is filled with many, when our comfort zones are compromised, like the man in the story this morning with all his family, we might want to kick some of them out. It's our head giving us a practical solution to a challenging problem. Scarcity, or perceived scarcity, it doesn't even have to be real scarcity, increases the space between our head and our heart. I wonder if any of you have ever felt this way when your adult children, for example, or your best friends come to your house for the holidays, and it's wonderful and you've been looking forward to it for months, and then when the holidays are finally over and you close the door behind them, you think, oh, I'm so glad they're gone. And those are people you like, theoretically. Above all, Coffin reminds us, we need to claim the kinship of all people to recover the prophetic insight that we belong one to another, every one of us, from the Pope to the lowliest wino on the planet. But we are challenged to remember that, especially when our default mode is one of scarcity as opposed to abundance. The opportunity cost of sharing our cake is greater when we think the cake is small, when we think our house is small, or our church is full enough, or when we think there's not enough room in our country for anyone else, when we feel protective of what we have, we think with our heads, and the space between the head and the heart is great. In our story this morning, the house felt crowded, right? Until it was even fuller with these extra creatures. And then when they left, it felt huge again. What changed? Only his perspective. He went from scarcity to abundance. There was not one square foot more, nor one person less than there had been at the beginning. But his experience shifted and his heart changed. We come here to be changed, hopefully to be challenged and comforted, but also to be poked a little bit, to be reminded in what is involved in being our best selves. I mentioned to someone recently that James Luther Adams says that church is a place where you get to practice what it means to be human. And I hope by that he meant we get to practice making the distance between head and heart as small as possible, where what comes out of us is both and, a sense of logical thinking informed by loving abundance. And as much as I love what Kathleen McTeague calls our Sabbath home that we heard earlier, where we turn our busy minds towards silence and our full hearts towards one another, I hope we are learning to take that compassion and courage into our everyday, not just our Sabbath day, blessing all places with our joy and our gratitude, lest we suffer de Tocqueville's paltriness of aim. We're on the cusp of celebrating the annual holiday of the heart, St. Valentine's Day. You have until Saturday, if you celebrate it. We might be tempted to imagine that the heart is all, that as George, Paul, John, and Ringo suggested, all you need is love. And it's true that love stretches our hearts. Love helps us feel that all things are possible, and that we are indeed connected from the Pope to the loneliest wino. And when that abundance sits right here next to our heads, the distance so small as to be negligible, then our actions reflect possibility and creativity and courage and welcome. When the space between our head and our heart is small, we not only dream big, but we do big. Let's practice being that kind of human, because the world's needs are too great for anything less. Remember the words of Marion Wright Edelman: "Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking." So let's get together our hearts right up here next to our heads and do great and wonderful, powerful things for the world. It will make our spirits soar. So may it be. Our closing hymn is a challenge today. It may be familiar to some of you. It's called Standing on the Side of Love, and it was a part of what inspired, or what continues to inspire, the movement that is Standing on the Side of Love, a justice movement that our Unitarian Universalist friends and family all over the world are trying to live by.